Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
Today, Zach and I will devote our time on this podcast to two separate topics that have come up in the Asia-Pacific recently. First, we'll discuss a surprise visit by senior North Korean officials to South Korea this weekend, following which we will briefly discuss Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's trip to the United States. Zach, do you want to tell us a bit about what exactly happened this weekend in South Korea?
Yeah, Ankit. So what basically went down is it was the closing of the Asian Athletic Games, and all of a sudden on early Saturday morning, North Korea's official media posted a story that said that basically it's number two and number three, Hwang and Cho, along with one of its main officials who deals with South Korea, were going to be visiting South Korea on a surprise. They just left for South Korea for a surprise visit, and then sure enough, an hour later, they arrived at the city where the games are being held. And so this is the first time the person who's believed to be North Korea's number two visited South Korea. So it's been 14 years since North Korea's number two's visited South Korea. In addition, this one was even more significant because both Hwang and Cho being the former number two of North Korea and one who's the number two until a few months ago. So to have two, it was, from what I read, this has never happened. There's never been a higher level delegation than this from North Korea to South Korea. And then it was also weird because it was not announced beforehand by either North or South Korea. South Korea claimed that this visit had come about within 24 hours, that Friday morning North Korea had asked if these officials could come to South Korea to attend the games. Now, I'm somewhat skeptical myself that that's true, but obviously the fact that it was a surprise visit is somewhat different than usually how high-level summits between the Koreas go. And what makes this all more significant, and what I think we'll end up talking about today, is that this is all taking place in the context of Kim Jong-un and not being seen since, I think, September 3rd was the exact date last time you see him in public. It was sometime early, one of the first few days of September was the last time I see him in public. So there's already speculation about what's going on with him. The belief before this visit was he was sick, but a lot of the North Korean watchers were wondering if this meant something else might be going on with Kim Jong-un, or if this is tied to his disappearance. So I guess, Ankit, what is your view on that?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to note that it's interesting that Hwang is also he's also the first deputy director of the Korean Workers' Party Organization and Guidance Department, the OGD, which recently a lot of North Korean defectors have pointed to that as sort of an alternate locus of power within North Korea, aside from Kim Jong-un. So there's been a lot of speculation, particularly based on what defectors have to say, but obviously you have to take that with a grain of salt, that the OGD might be an area in the North Korean government apparatus that is essentially challenging Kim Jong-un's leadership.
Give our listeners a preview. We're actually going to have a story about that, a feature article about the debate over how powerful the OGD is coming up on The Diplomat either this week or early next week. So I just want to, if you're interested in that topic, keep a lookout for that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a good one. Also, Zach, I think it's really interesting. You noted this in your piece that the officials, they arrived for the closing of the games and they actually ended up returning back that night, which, as you correctly pointed out, that suggests that they weren't there to negotiate some sort of agreement or, essentially talk to South Korean officials. They might have been there to deliver a message. And again, we're sitting here in the dark, but it's definitely telling that they were only there for, less than 24 hours for sure.
Yeah, I think that is a huge point, and I think one I made in the article is that, if you see a high level delegation like this, is usually never going to go to South Korea without there being some plan to have an agreement that's going to be reached or something, or if they really do just need to negotiate high level sensitive issues, and junior level officials cannot do it and put in lieu of these senior level officials, and since their visit was so short, it seems. And since there's no big agreements at the end or anything, it seems like it could have been for that reason. So it seems like you said it has to be about a message. That being said, I think there are some signs that suggest that this visit was planned ahead of time. Most notably, there's when they were negotiating for the North Korea's athletic delegation, these games, it was like very intense talks, and the talks broke down, which was a little odd because, you know, it was just an athletic delegation. Why it had been so difficult to reach that, and why there had been such intense negotiations over it in the first place, seemed odd at the time. And now that this trip happened, it seems like it's possible that maybe the reason those talks have broken down and been so intense was because they were playing this trip. In addition, Hwang was just given Cho's a second title from Cho, like right before this visit, like the end of September, or the end of September. He was given Cho's vice chairmanship on the National Defense Commission. And it seemed throughout the visit that one of the things North Korea was trying to establish was that Hwang was now North Korea's number two, and that he was senior to Cho, who, like I said, was just used to be the number two, but has recently surrendered his titles to Hwang. So it seems like the reason that Hwang getting that title so close to when this visit happened seems like it might have been tied to that visit. So it's not certain that this was, although South Korea claims this came about within the last 24 hours, it's possible that just their the public position the Koreas are taking. I actually tried to get the State Department to tell me if the U.S. State Department, when the South Korea's government had informed the U.S. about this trip, whether, first of all, that they had informed them about this trip at all, and if so, if had they done a few days or weeks ago, but I couldn't get, all they would tell me was that they supported inter-Korean relations.
Yeah, I think it's also worth noting that Danny Russell and David Scheer of the State Department were also in South Korea for a separate, they were briefing about the U.S.-Japan bilateral security guidelines. But they also discussed the issue of this North Korean visit. But again, there was very little information that was publicly released. I think it's also worth reminding our listeners that all of what we're discussing right now comes after last December's major incident in North Korean politics when a Jang Sung-taek, who was then essentially the number two within the North Korean regime by all measures, and was also number two to Kim Jong-un's predecessor, his father, Kim Jong-il, was assassinated. Which also sparked off a lot of speculation about.
Wait, he wasn't assassinated. He's put executed.
Executed, right? Sorry.
yeah.
But yeah, it's you know, obviously there's major changes happening within the regime right now, and it seems like an extension of Kim Jong-un's power consolidation and a transfer of power overall.
Well, Jang, he was actually the last number two North Korean number two to visit South Korea. He was the number two that visited in 2002, but. Yeah, that it does come in the wake of that. I think there's like a couple of issues here, or a couple of possibilities. One is that, you know, it's just coincidental that this appearance, that, you know, or this trip happened to coincide with Kim Jong-un's absences. Because honestly, these kind of absences happen all the time among top North Korean leaders. I don't think they've happened to Kim Jong-un yet, but I think I remember them having their father, I believe, and then last year they happened to his wife. Last year, everyone thought his wife was dead because she had stopped showing up to public appearances. And then Cho, earlier this year, everyone thought Cho had been purged and had been executed because he wasn't hadn't shown up in public for a month or so. And so, you know, when this, so I don't think like it's necessarily the case that just because Kim Jong-un hasn't been seen that something huge has happened. It's the North Korean state media has actually said that he has discomfort right now, which everyone took to mean sick, that he's having health problems, and it could just be routine health problems. Because the visit's the only reason that makes his absence more interesting to me. So, but the other possibilities, even if there is something big going on with Kim Jong-un, it's, you know, there's a bunch of different possibilities. One that is, he was like assassinated. One that he's really sick and they expect him to die. One that he did die from a health disease, or one that there's a military coup. And a lot of people want to focus on the possibility that there's a military coup, but I actually think that's the least likely option. And I say that because Hwang, although he comes from the OGD, as you mentioned, Ankit, he was about in 2010 when Kim Jong-un began rising to the, or was officially made the successor to his father. Hwang was like a middle management person at OGD, and since Kim Jong-un's come to power, he just shot up the ranks of first that organization, and now all these other different parts of the DBRK. So it seems that Hwang's rise is due solely to Kim Jong-un, and that makes sense because Hwang's actually younger and part of the Kim Jong-un's generation age-wise. So it seems like if there was a military coup that took out Kim Jong-un, then Hwang wouldn't be behind it and certainly wouldn't be the face of it. It would have been, he would have probably been a victim of it.
Right, that's a good point. No, I think you're right that the most benign explanation here is simply the fact that Kim Jong-un might actually be sick, and therefore this delegation is simply representing him or delivering a message. Obviously, again, it's difficult to sort of crack the North Korean black box, but we're definitely witnessing some interesting events.
Yeah.
Anyways, you want to take this conversation over to Modi's trip to the United States?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so as diplomat readers and listeners will be aware, India's new Prime Minister Narendra Modi spent 5 days in the United States last week, and he had a fairly packed agenda. However, despite how busy his agenda might have been and the entire host of figures he met with everybody from the president to the former president Bill Clinton, possibly future president Hillary Clinton. He spoke to an audience of 20,000 here in New York City at Madison Square Garden. But overall, he ended up leaving the United States with fewer deliverables than many people hoped. I had a piece up basically highlighting 10 major takeaways on security cooperation between the U.S. and India, which was actually I was actually pleasantly impressed by the extent to which the joint statement that the two governments released after Modi's meeting with Obama addressed pretty much the entire gamut of security issues facing the two countries. This was the first time, for example, a U.S.-India joint statement referred to the South China Sea, where the two countries called for the freedom of navigation to be respected in accordance with the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. It seems like India is making that a part of its regular diplomacy now. Recently, when India's president visited Vietnam, he also left with a joint statement that had a similar statement about the South China Sea. Additionally, when it comes to security, another major breakthrough was the fact that India looks to be all set to accede to the nuclear suppliers group, which is going to prove pretty important in terms of normalizing India's status as a nuclear power. India, as some readers and listeners might be aware, is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but is nonetheless recognized as a nuclear weapon state. In 2005, under the Bush administration, the United States signed an agreement that allowed it to engage in normal civilian nuclear commerce with India, which really helped normalize New Delhi as a nuclear state. Anyway, Zach, I don't want to ramble on too long after this. And, you know, what's your a take on, you know, the current state of U.S.-India diplomacy? Where are these two countries going in your view?
I mean, I think that there's support among the elites on both sides for, in the abstract at least, for strengthening the relationship. But, I mean, it continues to under-impress everyone. And nothing about this visit makes me think that that's suddenly about to change. I mean, it was necessary to have this visit because of the U.S. having banned Modi when he wasn't, you know, before he came to power from traveling the U.S. So they need to get over that bump. But, I mean, whenever you have a big-time leadership summit between, you know, countries like the India and the U.S. and nothing – like you said, I was actually really surprised about how much they got done or how much they focused on defense issues. But besides that, I mean, I just don't think there was anything like the kind of big things that you – a big, like, stunning single achievement that you kind of want – to drive the conversation after one of these summits. But what about your views?
Yeah, I mean, I should also point out that, you know, if you look at the Indian press, a lot of the analysis there is focusing on the fact that this visit was really directed at the Indian diaspora. Specifically, when Modi was campaigning for prime minister, some of his biggest supporters, both financially and otherwise, were actually based outside the country, notably in the United States. You know, there's about 3 million Indian Americans that are based in this country. And I think, you know, Modi really hit home that idea when he spoke at Madison Square Garden. I mean, that spectacle really spoke to the fact that this visit had, you know, several audiences. On one hand, he had a support base back in India. He had his supporters in the United States. And then, of course, he had the U.S. government and Congress people and other representatives that he met with. Also, I mean, part of Modi's diplomacy, you know, Zach, you and I are more focused on security issues, but, you know, when it comes to economic matters, I think Modi's made that his first priority. I think we've seen that in his diplomacy, both with other major powers, including Japan and China, but also in the United States. You know, he's here to sell India as an attractive destination for U.S. investment. And to some extent, you know, he did a good job of that. I mean, as you pointed out, it seems like in the United States, there's pretty much overwhelming bipartisan support for closer relations with India. I mean, right when Modi met with the president, you had John McCain issuing an op-ed calling for a pivot to India, and you had another Republican congressperson calling Modi the new Ronald Reagan for the world. So there's really, this isn't an issue that's dividing Republican and Democrat. It's simply something that, I think both countries have been waiting for the right leader. And if you contrast Modi with his predecessor, Manmohan Singh, who was often seen as soft-spoken and meek and not really one to take action on the U.S.-India relationship and not really able to control domestic politics back in India, where there is actually a substantial degree of opposition and skepticism about a closer U.S.-India relationship, Modi, I think, is seen as someone who can transcend that. And I think a lot of that obviously has to do with the fact that he came to power on the strongest democratic mandate seen by any leader in India in about 30 years. So, all that said, I mean, I was pleasantly surprised with this visit. I mean, obviously, we're looking for more deliverables here, and there are major issues that are still outstanding in U.S.-India relations. For example, the issue of the nuclear liability law that makes India an incredibly hostile destination for U.S. nuclear commerce pretty much went unaddressed. The issue of India's voting record at the WTO, which irked the United States, went unaddressed. The issue of India's status on climate change, again, that was something that wasn't really talked about too much. So, I think you're right. I mean, there's a lot of gaps that remain that need to be filled here.
Yeah, my views, my concerns are about the limitations of U.S.-India relations are based on these specific issues and most of what you mentioned. But they're also like more fundamental. They're partly that I don't like you were saying, like you were saying, there's not exactly a ton of bipartisan support in India, at least like among the larger elites for U.S. There's a lot of skepticism towards the U.S. among a lot of people in India, and while there's but. And while Modi might transcend this, it seems to me that he was more focused on other, like you were saying again, other asks. He didn't seem that interested in the Obama summit as much as other things. So it seems like he wants to use the U.S. relationships, pursue the U.S. relations in a different way, basically using more of the private sector approach. The other thing is, while there is bipartisan support among the U.S. elite, and you are like absolutely, it seems like every Democrat and every Republican will tell you that they support stronger U.S.-India relations. I just don't see. There's no. It's not like such a focus for any of them. Like when Modi's in town, John McCain will deliver remarks at the Carnegie Center, post those on foreign policy as a as an op-ed. But what is Senator John McCain's focus like day in and day out? And I think it's pretty clear it's the Middle East, and it's even more so China than India. So I don't think there's like any. Even though everyone does support it, India relations. Relations with India, that no one is like makes that their biggest issue, and so I think that's kind of troubling because it leaves it so that there's the relationships aren't constantly tended to, and then things happen like the consulate general, India's consulate general situation from last year.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's very difficult for the United States foreign policy establishment to see India as a priority on the level of, crises in the Middle East and the rise of China and other issues like that. It's pretty much a constant refrain. I mean, for the past decade that we need better, closer ties between the U.S. and India, but nothing really ends up happening. I mean, and then, you also have the issue of Pakistan. I mean, right before Modi arrived in the United States, the U.S. finalized the sale of 160 MRAPs to Pakistan. I mean, that again kind of speaks to, I mean, that even takes you back further, back to the Cold War when relations between the United States and India weren't, I mean, both sides weren't calling for closer relations. There was a lot of Cold War skepticism, but, that was back in the hyphenization era when it was India, Pakistan. And I think a lot of Indians were kind of soured on that. And they continued to see the United States essentially, propping up Pakistan as a threat to India, and that's also going to continue to be an issue, I think.
Yeah, and the U.S., I mean, the U.S. side, even though, I mean, it knows that India has a problem with it in Pakistan, it doesn't fundamentally seem to, like, want to deal with that issue, that it's going to, at some point, probably have to pick one or the other. It can't, not necessarily break off relationship with one, but, it's got to lean towards one side. Otherwise, both sides are going to be skeptical of it. And that brings up another point, just basically, too, that, like, I just don't think India trusts the United States. And I just don't think that, like, anytime soon, that, I think there's always going to be this deep skepticism. And I think that the U.S. also wants to put values, these democratic values, front and center of the relationship. And I see that as a bad idea because I don't think India really bases its foreign policy on, you know, spreading democracy like the U.S. does. I mean, it takes pride in its democratic state, but it sees itself more, I think, as a developing state than a democracy on the world stage. It sees itself more as a BRICS, basically, than you know, a European democracy. You think that's fair to say, or do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I completely agree. Yeah, I mean, India has always prized strategic autonomy above all else. And while that might be less true today, it still remains a major tenet of Indian foreign policy. I mean, I think the wrong way to understand U.S.-India relations would be to imagine that they could ever be like anything like, you know, U.S.-UK relations, for example, which, you know, is obviously a very special relationship that's tied up in values and all that. I mean, yes, the democratic values feature very prominently in the rhetoric here, but I think that's more in the context of having India as a pole in a potential multipolar world that would essentially uphold the U.S.-created liberal order after the post-World War era. I think it's also interesting to note that, you know, the United States is looking at cooperating with India in a trilateral context with Japan and Asia, which I think is a pretty productive way, actually, for the two countries to go about their cooperation, since India has significantly, if not more developed relations with Japan, the trust, I think, is definitely more prevalent there than
yeah,
with
I think,
the United States.
Sorry. I think that I was going to say that Modi, I think, probably prioritizes Japan relationships and Abe relationships more than relationships with the U.S., at least, you know, Obama, the U.S. and the U.S. government. So I think that probably that whole triangularization of the relationship, that the progress has made on that front, was probably driven by Modi.
I think you're right. In any case, I mean, I think we've seen, with Modi, I mean, Modi's going to be around for another 4 years. I think there'll be a lot of room for growth in U.S.-India relations. I mean, like I said, you know, I think this first visit definitely, I think, set a positive tone for where a bilateral ties between these two countries are going. In any case, that's all the time we have on this week's podcast. Just as a note, we are aware of the fact that there are some quite interesting events unfolding in Hong Kong, and we will be back later this week with Shannon Tiezzi, who's our China editor, to discuss that in more detail. We'll be devoting an entire podcast to the Hong Kong protests and Occupy Central and the Umbrella Revolution and all that. Thanks a lot for listening. We'll be back next week with more.
Till then.